Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The FT.
Welcome to Banking Weekly from the Financial Times with me, Patrick Jenkins. Joining me in the studio today is the FT's retail banking correspondent, Charlene Goff, Daniel Schaefer, investment banking correspondent, and Brooke Masters, our chief regulation correspondent. This week, the impact of the bailout of Spanish bank Bankia.
There is a growing concern about the amount of stuff the ECB is holding that's not very good.
Also, what is the future for free banking in the UK?
Banking isn't really free. You don't pay a monthly fee for it. You pay through other sort of more hidden charges.
And finally, on investment banks, are cost cuts really possible?
There have been two decades where banking paid much, much more than the rest of the private sector, and that's been in the 1920s and the first decade of this century.
First, though, to the topic of Spain and Spain's troubled banks, particularly Bankia. This is the second biggest domestic bank, and it doesn't seem to be a week that goes by without more drama occurring there. Last Friday, we had news that 19 billion euros more was going to be injected into this institution to prop it up. Over the weekend, it emerged that Spain wanted to do that in some kind of weird structure, not actually injecting cash, but injecting its own debt. Charlene, this is reminiscent, not really of very much in the past. This is pretty unique, but it does call into mind something that happened in Ireland a few years ago.
Yes, back in 2010, a fairly similar structure was used to prop up what was then Anglo-Irish, which was the worst of Ireland's big three banks, and which has since was nationalised and has now been merged with a much smaller failed lender, Irish Nationwide Building Society. So they were the sort of the two worst, and these similar sort of idea was used for both those institutions, by which Ireland effectively injected bonds into them that then they could use as collateral at the ECB. It's slightly different in Ireland because it wasn't sort of used as a way to increase their regular liquidity. It was more kind of if they needed the collateral against sort of riskier assets. But this time with Bankia, it would be used just for their sort of day-to-day liquidity, which is even more unusual.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like they're trying to... we don't know exactly what the liquidity needs are, I suppose, but the kind of prime reason for doing this, or injecting the 19 billion, is because their equity needs propping up in order to take the losses on, or latent losses on their real estate investments. But I suppose the key thing is that it basically puts the net cost or the net cash cost of recapitalising Spain's worst bank onto the ECB, which is going to be quite controversial. Yeah, it makes it much cheaper for Spain because rather than actually issuing the debt in the market and paying, well, at today's levels, more than 6.5% yield on that debt, it's just injecting the debt straight into Bankia. Yeah. We don't know yet for how long it will, you know, whether it'll be 10-year, 20-year, 30-year bonds.
That's where it is unusual, because I think normally, and Britt, you know, you are more familiar in these sorts of matters, but, you know, I think normally you can deposit money with the ECB for about 3 months. So this would be far longer term than we've seen so far.
Yeah, well, we still don't know. I don't think Spain has decided what exactly it wants to do in terms of the details of this, but presumably they have to get some kind of deal with the ECB in order to be able to get this stuff repoed at the on a sustainable basis.
Well, it's a little bit reminiscent of what the ECB tried to do with Greece, where they started taking all kinds of assets for repo that they wouldn't ordinarily accept. There is a growing concern. I had a lunch today with some bankers about the amount of stuff the ECB is holding that's not very good. I mean, the ECB itself doesn't have that much capital relative to the amount, the billions and billions of euros in sort of shaky government bonds it is now holding.
Yeah, I can't believe that there's many people at the ECB today who are going to be rejoicing about the Spanish government's plans.
No, absolutely. And also, earlier this year, we saw Anglo-Irish and Irish Nationwide actually strike a deal to delay payments. So even though it was a sort of more cost-effective way of doing it back in 2010, they're still struggling to make the, you know, huge repayments they have on these loans now. And, you know, that will be a sort of sign that would presumably make the ECB officials feel quite nervous about doing the same on a much, you know, sort of bigger and more risky scale with Bankia. I said, what does this mean 2 or 3 years down the line?
Yeah, absolutely. And just in case that wasn't enough bad news, I think by the end of Monday, we're going to have had results from Bankia's holding company parent organization, BFA, which, according to the Spanish press, is going to report the biggest loss in Spanish corporate history. So that's a nice little thing for the ECB to look forward to as being a background story for them. We should move on to our second topic of the day, and free banking, which has been an institution in British banking for getting on for 30 years.
Yeah.
Midland Bank introduced it basically, and the rest of the market followed in the early 1980s. And it's been with us ever since. But there's kind of increasing talk, Charlene, that people would like to see the back of it. Banks mostly would probably like to see the back of it because they want to be able to charge their customers. But regulators also want to see the back of it.
Yeah, they have done for a while, actually. And this time around, it was Andrew Bailey, who's in charge of supervising banks for the FSA, who said in a speech last week that, you know, he wanted to see the end of free banking, that it was a dangerous myth. By that, he meant that, you know, banking isn't really free. It's just the actual, you don't pay a monthly fee for it. You pay through other sort of more hidden charges and opaque fees. And that's what people really hate about it. That's what he hates about it. He thinks it would be a better world if everyone knew exactly what they were paying for, had greater transparency, and just said, OK, you know, you're not going to be hit with these huge overdraft charges or overseas fees, for example, and instead you'll have an upfront fee. Now, he said all this before, actually, about 6 months ago, and it's just been a topic that constantly comes up. It was one of the big issues of Vickers, the Independent Banking Commission that, you know, we spent a lot of time talking about last year and, you know, finally got their recommendations in September. Now, they avoided it altogether, and that's been the decision of most people, because at the end of the day, you know, we're in a competitive market, we're supposed to be in an open market, and to have this sort of interventionist approach where, you know, banks are forbidden to offer free banking would be somewhat in conflict with what the public want, you know, who are, feel it's very popular and don't want to be suddenly hit by a £10 a month charge for their basic bank account.
Which is why the government appointed commission, the Vickers Commission, I'm sure, kind of avoided it. It would be electorally kind of poisonous to institute this kind of
thing. Any government would be mad, and that was the feedback we got following Andrew Bailey's speech, is that it would be incredibly difficult for the Treasury to impose anything like this.
Nonetheless, Andrew Bailey did talk about having some kind of intervention. Now, he wasn't clear about what he meant, Brooke, but did he mean, do you think, the regulator, or did he mean the government? Or,
well, it should be noted that Andrew Bailey has no power to do anything, because he, when the FSA splits up, moves into the PRA, which is the Prudential Regulatory Authority, which does safety and soundness of banks. It does not regulate products at all.
So this would have to be covered by the other bit of the FSA, as will be the Financial Conduct Authority.
Right, and that's run by Martin Wheatley. And the FCA also has real doubts about free banking, because they believe it encourages mis-selling, because banks try to make up the money they don't get from charging for banking by cross-selling you lovely things like PPI.
So is this Andrew Bailey, though, trying to kind of nudge Martin Wheatley down a route that he'd like him to take? Or what is going on here?
I think this is a personal hobby horse of his, is that he thinks nobody has the guts to take this on. And because in a way, it's free for him, because he doesn't actually have to put his money where his mouth is and do something. He keeps raising the issue in hopes that it would do it. The real way you could probably at least begin to address it through regulatory intervention is through required transparency, where, like, with your bank account, you know, with your statement, maybe every 6 months you get this is what you would have gotten if you'd put this money someplace else, and this is what you've paid in other fees.
And we are seeing moves towards that. That was one of the elements in Vickers, that they wanted that exact kind of exposure.
Yeah, that's about disclosure. As far as they went, didn't it?
Yeah, and they wanted that on your annual statement, so you know, A, what you've paid in charges, and B, what you've lost because you didn't get interest on that money. So that will make it easier to compare accounts and you know, give people a better idea what they're
and the
paying.
Banks seem to be, I mean, Lloyds is talking about doing that already or wanting to do that, having put that forward. It feels like the banks are kind of on side to go at least that far.
They are. And also we are seeing a gradual evolution towards paid for banking. Like there's this big account that's being mass marketed by Santander at the moment, their 123 current account, which you have to pay for.
Yeah.
But you don't just pay for it and you get nothing in return. You get cash back on various different services. And every time you spend money, you get money back. And so it's that kind of evolution, I think, or, you know, potentially banks starting to charge for some of their digital services that are a bit more sophisticated than the ones we've seen so far. We're moving there slowly, but I don't think we're going to get this big bang change like we did back in the 1980s when we saw free banking come in.
Right, so intervention is probably not going to happen, but maybe we get evolution towards non-free banking. Our final topic for today is on the other side of the banking industry, the investment banking sphere, which is becoming an even more difficult sphere post-crisis and post-kind of regulatory change in which to come up with a business model that looks sustainably profitable. Not many people would believe that given the paychecks that a lot of investment bankers get every year. But Daniel, you think that we should take seriously the idea that investment banking has to address its cost issues if it's going to be sustainable?
Yes, indeed. I mean, the cost base in terms of remuneration, both in the front office, which is where everybody's actually looking at, the big millions checks the traders are getting, but also in the back office of banks is something that will continue to be a really big topic in the next few years, maybe even bigger than it already has been in the past. And the reason for this is, since the financial crisis, banks have started slowly to address their cost base, and they started to, you know, try to clamp down on bonuses. And despite the public outcry over big bonus checks that are still being paid, the overall amount, there's a new research piece now showing by the Association of Financial Markets in Europe, which is the sort of lobby organization for the investment banks. Yeah. It's showing that total amount of variable pay, i.e. mostly bonuses on a per capita basis, is down 55% since 2007. So that has decreased. But on the other side of the coin, the fixed salaries of bankers have actually increased by 37% since 2007.
Now, Brooke, that's in part, isn't it, because of new regulations that came in at a European level, kind of regulate what top bankers could get in terms of their variable pay.
That is true. There are limits. You can only pay, of a variable bonus, you can only pay basically 25% of it in cash.
Yeah.
25% more can be in immediate stock, and then the remaining half has to be deferred. It also, some of the regulators were strongly in favor of this move. There was a feeling that things that were called bonuses were actually what people were living on, and they wanted the banks to be more honest and say, look, some of this bonus is not a bonus. It's what everybody lives on. You know, call the salary, and the bonus, and so that in bad years, you really could pay no bonus. So it's not surprising that as they cut back bonus, they did increase salary somewhat, although I think that amount is quite startling.
So we shouldn't see it simplistically as fixed versus variable, because some of the old variable was effectively fixed.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, critics of the kind of direction of regulation point out that some of the new rules that we're going to get, potentially another European initiative that's in the parliament there to restrict the kind of bald proportion of bonus against salary, will do yet again push up salaries. They're kind of talking about a ratio of 1-to-1 maximum.
Although it should be noted that Michel Barnier, who is the commissioner for the financial markets, has got an alternate idea coming through as part of a much larger corporate governance.
Which is the vote
towers.
On pay.
And the idea is that fixed ratios are probably not a brilliant idea, for exactly the reason Daniel has pointed out, which is that they really lock you in terms of fixed cost.
I mean, it is actually quite dramatic for investment banks in terms of what the problems they need to address, because they've done a lot of cost cutting, but still, if you compare the cost income ratios of banks, the average investment bank between 2007 and 2011, in 2007 it was 60%, and now it's 80%. So even after all the cost cutting, they've got a higher cost income ratio. So
that's largely because the income being so much lower.
Yeah, because income
now
went down. Yeah, a lot. So and you know, it's predicted not to get back to the old levels, if not fall further.
In part because of other regulatory constraints on the capital side.
And on a more general philosophical basis, if you say there is an it's part of a bigger adjustment process where the financial services industry will come back to more normal salary levels in the next, say, 5 to 10 years, because there's an academic research study last year showing that there have been two basically decades where banking paid much, much more than the rest of the private sector. And that's been in the 1920s and the first decade of this century.
Yeah.
And with sometimes 70% being paid more in the banking industry. And even regardless of the function, so even in back office function like HR, people were paid 70% more, just despite not adding any value, more value than they would do at, say, a chemical company or so. And that's neat. That's something investment banks will need to address in the future.
I'm sure there's lots of politicians listening to you talk who will be very glad to hear that. That's all we have time for this week, unfortunately. Just need to thank Brooke and Charlene and Daniel for their contributions, and thank you for listening. Remember, you can keep up to date with all of the latest banking stories at ft.com/banking. We'll be taking a break next week for the Queen's Jubilee Bank Holiday weekend, but we'll be back on Monday, the 11th of June. I look forward to addressing you then.
For more downloads, go to ft.com/podcasts.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.